This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Thank you all for being here this morning. I am always incredibly grateful for the opportunity to come here to Jikoji. I flew in yesterday from Michigan. I've been living in residence at a monastery out there for the last 13 years, studying with my teacher, Sokuzan. But just, it's always so warming to be here. It feels like coming home to Jikoji, and I have tremendous gratitude to all of those that continue to make this space available. And so I thought I'd start in a terrible place to start a Dharma talk. Is there anything you'd like to know about? I can start talking. I'm happy to ramble a bit. But if there's any burning questions about meditation, about the practice, about this path, be happy to start there as well. Yes.
So this is my first time, and it strikes me that these teachings seem quite at odds with the culture of Silicon Valley, which brought us all here.
Could you repeat the question? My hearing sense of it.
One more time, please.
It seems like the teachings of this practice is quite at odds with the culture of Silicon Valley, which is about like striving and achieving, doing new things. So, or getting something or making money. It seems like this is quite at odds with that. Do you have any suggestions for people who might live in both worlds?
Meditate. Thank you. We could start with that commonality that I think many of us probably share. If you come to Jikoji, or you've come to the spiritual path, or you are searching, and if there's any duration to that search or that practice or that endeavor, the foundation for most of us was the Buddha's first teaching of suffering, dissatisfaction. You wouldn't be in this room, or you probably won't come back, if there's not some sort of dissatisfaction happening or suffering. If you weren't suffering, you would be somewhere not suffering. You'd be quite content. You would be doing quite well. And Buddhism endeavors to address that quite directly, but perhaps not in a way that you would imagine. So the contradiction, what was your name?
Peter.
Kind of creating this contrast of Silicon Valley and Jikoji. I'm not from California at all, so I don't know much about Silicon Valley. It's kind of a catchy phrase. Someone said, I'm from Silicon Valley, and I had no idea where they're from. It's somewhere in California, right? Is it a city? Is it
Santa Clara County.
Santa Clara County. So they don't say I'm from Santa Clara County. They say I'm from Silicon Valley. What surprises some of us about Buddhism, though, is it's not a contradiction to anything in particular. In fact, if Buddhism contradicts anything, it fuels the very warfare, the very tension, the very duality that started this path. And so perhaps a good place to start this talk is to acknowledge the way in which Buddhism endeavors to help us address this seeming tension, the seeming conflict, the seeming contradiction. So you're having difficulty. You may just call it tension. Some of us may go so far as to say, well, I have depression, anger issues. I'm anxious. I have a fear of being inadequate, of not living up to a standard, of not accomplishing. But there's some sort of tension arising. And initially, our approach to this would be, how do I get rid of this tension? How do I not feel inadequate? How do I not feel anger? How do I not feel sad? How do I not feel like things are about to pop? And so we begin to approach the world with this idea of, how can I pacify? How can I get rid of? How can I destroy the negativity? And so we overcompensate with an artificial hope for positivity. We start to find people that tell us, just have a good attitude, just work hard, just think positive thoughts. And so that works for a little bit initially. But you have this rawness. So let's call our sensitivity, our tension, rawness. It hurts. It's like an open wound that someone pokes. And so then we take positivity and we cover it up. But the rawness is still there. It's still there. We've not addressed it. We've not seen it. But we found a way temporarily to alleviate that suffering. But I emphasize temporarily. So let's say we find a good partner, someone we really love, and we don't have to look at our own negativity. But then our partner starts to become very ordinary, and we see them as a human being, and it's not enough to cover up. So we start to blame our partner because we still have this rawness. And so then we start to look for something else. Well, maybe I'll try drugs. That's kind of fun. Some nods. Yeah, it's kind of fun. And so we start to cover it up by intoxicating ourselves, distracting ourselves. But then we become bored with that, and the rawness is still there. We've not addressed it. So then we step into a Zendo. And for many of you this morning, you met with Jiro, who's been meditating probably longer than I have. And he teaches you how to sit down, take a very simple posture, and you take a radical attitude. You take a radical attitude, which is whatever arises without exception, I'm going to endeavor to receive. This is very difficult to do. The practice of meditation is not easy. It's not an instant fix. It's not instant relief. It is saying, for once, instead of trying to modify this rawness, I'm going to endeavor to look directly at it. I'm not going to re-strategize my life. So let's look at that practice. It's very simple. You start with your body. You can find your body, right? You can find it. Mind, not so easy. Mind's very slippery. It's always showing up in different ways, but we can find our body. So we do with our body what we can't do with our minds. We just hold still. Don't have to maintain it through aggression, but we hold the body still. It's upright, intentional, and the hands take this very simple gesture, this mudra, cosmic mudra, and it rests in the lap. And here is where meditation just lets us down. You don't have to do anything else. We're so programmed to accomplish our lives. We are so programmed to strategize and execute our lives that when we come to a practice like Shikantaza or Zazen, we're let down because we see directly, we see intimately that there's nothing to do. We begin to soften our attitude by seeing that when you sit down to meditate, everything is welcome. It's like in the summertime in the Zendo, all the doors get opened up. Everything's welcomed in. There's screens, the bugs aren't really allowed in. So maybe we'd have to take the screens down. But the attitude in meditation is that your practice is not defined by what arises in your mind. Your practice, your ability to sit in Shikantaza, your ability to sit meditation, disappointing, is not defined by how you feel. Because if it's defined by how you feel, it will always have something to oppose. There will always be that polarity, that potential for warfare, trying to maintain meditation as opposed to the rest of the mundane world. This is the embodiment of the mundane world and the spiritual world all at once. This posture completely embodies the absolute and the relative without making a distinction. And Peter. So coming back to Peter's initial question, it's like Buddhism seems polarized, or it seems like it's in opposition to the attitude of Silicon Valley. Buddhism, as I understand it, is the attitude of Silicon Valley without any need to modify it. You don't need to empower it. You don't need to shut it down. You don't need to look away from it. So it's completely okay to have some inspiration to do something with your life. But it becomes complicated when it becomes a demand, when it starts to arise out of aggression or an insistence on a result. Some of us have natural dispositions. Some of us like to walk in the woods. Some of us like to listen to music. Some of us like to go swimming. Some of us get angry easily. Some of us become jealous easily. And Buddhism is not saying you're a bad person because you get angry, or Buddhism is not saying you're a bad person because you like to walk in the woods. But Buddhism is saying, see directly. See directly. So you take this posture, hold still, the eyes are open, and there's an intention to receive. And as you sit, maybe anger arises. Just arises. It's phenomena. It's dependently arisen. It's something that arises just like the sun comes up in the morning and it sets in the evening. So anger arises. And your first impulse is to say, I stopped meditating because I got angry. I've stopped meditating because I started to daydream. I've stopped meditating because I was wandering around in my thoughts. And so you try through force to stop those thoughts, to be a meditator. There was one of the great Zen masters of the Tang Dynasty. His name was Linji, or Zen Master Rinzai. And he often told his students, just be ordinary. Just be ordinary. And we have no humor in our lives because we're so desperately trying to get rid of something or live up to something else. And there's no space, there's no humor, there's no ability to just be ordinary. And meditation is our opportunity to see how profound ordinary is. So coming into this space and meeting with Jiro or Sokyo or Tetsuho, we just met yesterday, I'm learning names. And they invite you into the Zendo. And they say, you get to bring everything with you. You get to be a complete person. Come in here with your neurotic mind. Come in here with your compassionate mind. Come in here with your moving mind and your still mind. And in as far as you can, see that it's not your business to meddle with any one of those expressions, nor do you need to identify as any one of those expressions. They're spacious. It's like, sometimes it's talked about as being without a reference point. So when I say Buddhism lets you down or meditation lets you down, it's just that vulnerability. Be very vulnerable to sit down with your mind. It's the vulnerability to see that you don't have to live up to anything. You don't have to maintain anything. I've been studying another Zen master that is connected to our lineage named Koro Sawaki Roshi. And he was the teacher of Koben Shino Roshi, who was Shoho Mike's teacher, and our lineage directly descends through these teachers. And Koro Sawaki Roshi often talked about it as good for nothing Zen or worthless Zen, that it's perhaps one of the only things in our lives that we do for its own sake. That we sit zazen for zazen's sake. We sit meditation for meditation's sake. We actually fully embody this moment, not for the next moment, not for when we leave here and drive home, not for going to work tomorrow morning. We fully embody this moment for its own sake. And this moment is not special. This moment is the mind wandering, the mind being still. The mind being loud, the mind being quiet, the mind being aggressive, the mind being pacified, but it completely embodies itself. And so meditation endeavors to introduce us to the Buddha's first noble truth, that life is difficult. And he doesn't try to address the first noble truth by exchanging the difficulty for ease in a relative sense, but to say that you can live a life of ease in the midst of the difficulty. That so long as you have a human body, there'll be suffering. It may be the suffering of stubbing your toe, pain of just the physical nerve endings being abraded. It may be the pain of alternation, which is having something and losing it. That would be like having a wonderful partner and then not. Having a young body, having an old body. the alternation. Or it may be the pain of living in a world that's suffering, that we can't completely isolate ourselves from, that our lives may be going very well, but it's very hard not to feel the suffering of the world. So we don't want to hide out in Buddhism. We don't want to hide out in meditation. We want to endeavor to work with meditation to introduce ourselves to our world, introduce ourselves to our minds, and begin to soften this attitude that says you need to be different, that you need to live up to an expectation. And I would like to emphasize, it doesn't mean you can't have aspirations, that you can't have an intention to get the job you'd like, or to have a wonderful, loving, and supportive relationship, or that you can't work towards buying that Maserati you saw flying up the mountain. Nothing wrong with that. But it's the demand, it's the aggression that tends to come with that. See, like I said, I can just ramble on one question and I can just get going. But I feel truly inspired because this practice of meditation is not something obscure. It's not something that if anyone says, well, I can't meditate, I might not argue with them, but that's not true. Because you don't have to do it a special way. You get to do it. You just sit down. You just sit there. You can sit there. Even if you have to fidget a little bit, that's okay. You can sit there. And it might help us begin to look at how we create and we fuel our own suffering. Other questions?
I have a more practical question.
Yes.
So it doesn't sound right to suppress our daydreaming in meditation.
Yes.
It also doesn't sound right to follow it. So what should we do?
Yes, thank you. And the word I would use is observe. That's the word my teacher used, is observe. And so if you're sitting in meditation, we're not sitting there trying to like contemplate, like intellectually figure things out and get evidence here. So you're right. We're not chasing down thoughts, but we also don't want to suppress the thoughts. But the thoughts are going to arise spontaneously. If you sit there long enough, inevitably, it may be the sound of like in the evening, sometimes the turkeys come to roost and they're very loud. And you start to think about the turkeys. You can't really help that. So you notice how it comes up. And in as far as you can, you don't elaborate or shut down, knowing that you may spontaneously elaborate or shut down. So the awareness is primary. So if you can have that as an intention, you don't want to suppress thoughts, and you can have it as an intention, you don't want to fuel thoughts, then you begin to see what is observation? What does it mean to be aware of something without a demand? And it takes time because the mind can't do it. We're not talking about a way to execute this intellectually. So I once said that Buddhism or Zen in particular is about persistence. You just keep returning. You keep giving yourself over to that expression of this. And if you need to check in, if you need to see how you're doing, just try to check in with your body. You know, if you're sitting there and you start to daydream, I tend to notice that when I'm daydreaming, my head might drop like this. And so then I come back. Or that my body starts to slump. And I come back. So you can use the body to kind of come back to the intention. And knowing it's completely appropriate for times that your mind wanders and it's like the tension increases and it decreases and it increases and it decreases. So just returning over and over is what I would suggest. Further questions? Yes.
You said not intellectual.
Yes.
What does that mean? One of the subjects, I guess, is of interest to me is, I think his name is Dan, one of our guiding teachers. He mentioned that the Buddha primarily spoke in verse. coming back, just I'm wondering about this quite a lot. Just what I posed was a question, which seems linked to prose, how it works, this and that, juxtapose. I don't know, I'm still thinking. So, but you mentioned not, and yet this not is something also I struggle with, to allow all of it. So what does this mean? And that it could be rhetorical.
Oh, then I don't, that's lets me off the hook.
Yeah. So that's what I, so I hear this, and for most of my life, going to school, especially intellectual.
When I say that meditation practice is not intellectual, it's also not at the expense of the intellect. What I mean is that if you go to college and get a PhD in any form of Buddhism, and you learn every text by heart, this is not awakening. This is not intimacy. This is knowledge. Knowledge is good. Knowledge inspires us on the path. What we're doing right now is intellectual. We're asking questions about the Dharma. We're considering the Dharma. We're looking at the Dharma. So we're using the intellect. So it's helpful. I mean, most of us wouldn't be able to start if there wasn't some sort of way to access it. We start with the mind, the intellect. And so when we meditate, we don't need to hyper-analyze it and try to see, am I meditating? How do I meditate? What activity do I need to take to meditate? And at the same time, those thoughts arise spontaneously. This to me is where the persistence come in. I think of the image, I don't know if it was Suzuki Roshi who said this about awakening is like walking in the fog or the mist. You don't realize you're getting wet until you're soaked. So the persistence on the path is not necessarily accumulation, 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 that you just continue. You just continue to put yourself into this position with the attitude of receive without any intention to gain anything. And so the intellect comes into play, but we're not necessarily going to have some profound awakening just by having a new juicy thought or way to articulate the Dharma. And I think that the intimacy between a teacher and student for me has been pivotal in this, because the teacher can keep pulling the rug out from underneath you. You start to have an understanding of the Four Noble Truths. Life is suffering. The cause is desire. There is cessation. The cessation comes from the path of Sila, Samadhi, and Prajna, or discipline, meditation, and wisdom. So that was the Buddha's first teaching. And then the Heart Sutra comes along. It says no suffering, no source, no relief, no path. And you're like, wait, wait, wait. Suffering, source, relief, and path. But no suffering, no source, no release, no path. So the way the Buddha taught was very skillful in that it teaches to the situation and reminds us that we have to see this for ourselves. That I can say with all sincerity, I don't have anything special that I possess that I could give to you. Really, in some sense, have no right to be sitting up here. Don't have any profound awakening. I don't have special insights. But I have an encouragement that you could sit for yourselves and look at this, which is what my teacher gave to me and what his teacher gave to him. I don't know if that even comes close to what you were asking about.
It's fun.
Oh, good. Yeah.
I guess I should say that I've heard, that I've asked you, other people, the heart of this practice is in the sitting.
Yes.
This is done in silence.
The heart of this stillness practice is sitting.
And here, in here. So what more do you need?
I don't think you probably need much of anything. But our tendency And I wouldn't discourage that. If any of you feel like, yes, I fully taste how to practice, spend the rest of your life sitting and go out into the world and be kind. But what tends to happen is that our ego has little ways of getting its hands in there and appropriating meditation for its own means. And so we start to get a sense of accomplishment in meditation, thinking that we have felt it, but really we've just understood it. My teacher gave a talk one time and he said, drop down and rise up. So drop down out of the thinking process, rise up out of the impulsive primal gut and reside here. The mind can't do that. The mind can't reside in the heart. But it likes to create stories that says it does. And so that is where I come back to the idea of meditation is very vulnerable. It's a vulnerable practice because we don't actually get to accomplish it. We won't get to credentialize our meditation practice. And yet we can feel very good that we can just sit here and practice something for its own sake. And that's not to say that meditation doesn't permeate the entirety of our lives. I'm not saying that meditation is completely, thoroughly worthless. But it's not like a tool. It's not like learning how to speak a new language and going to that country and speaking that language. It's not like a tool of learning how to program software and then you can go program software. Meditation isn't a tool that you get to wield and engage your life in. It does it so effortlessly that it's not done consciously. So we meditate and you might find people coming up to you and saying, what's wrong? And you think about it and you say, I was just listening for once. I wasn't talking. Or really considering what's in front of you. But that's not the end of it. So I come back to what my teacher said over and over and over. Keep going. Train your mind. Keep going. Train your mind. Keep going. Go into retreat. Come to this space. You know, every Sunday, there's this wonderful group here. We meditate for about an hour. You have a chance to ask questions about the Dharma. Check back in. And then perhaps you're able to set up some practice at home. Maybe it's just 5 minutes a day. Maybe it's more. 10 minutes, 20, 30, 40, 50. But there's an opportunity to have a container for that practice.
You get by the end of the meditation, you've been practicing for years and years, can you get something?
Can you get something from meditation was the question. Relatively, yes. I think relatively that as you sit, you may have more insight about the ways in which you deceive yourself. We tend to act so impulsively that we don't even realize we're acting on impulse. It's just showing up. As we slow down and we sit down and we look at the mind, you might be able to begin to see the impulse before it becomes grasping or aggression or ignorance. But I think what is important to remember about this practice of Zazen is what makes it a spiritual path is it's not just about mundane results. And when I say mundane, I don't mean that disparagingly. I just mean the world of cause and effect. That this practice is not just about making this life tolerable or bearable or workable, but it's at the time of death, you see so clearly that you have no more questions. And in Zen, it's called the great matter. Life and death is called the great matter. So while you may have relative results, you may have relative progress, meditation may make your life more workable. We don't want to just stop when it becomes workable. And we don't necessarily want to say, well, meditation's not working when it gets more difficult. Tetsuho and I were talking this morning about meditation. And my experience has been for a lot of people when they first start to meditate, things might actually become more difficult. But your life, your mind might become more difficult, not because nothing anything new happens, but you've stopped trying to distract yourself from things you've been distracting yourselves from. That we might actually look at, yeah, there is some rawness there that I've been able to ignore for 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, 50 years, 60 years, 70 years, 80 years, 90 years, 100 years. And so I just want to be very considerate to say that meditation isn't just going to look like relative progress. That initially you come to meditation, you feel grateful, it feels good. And then a week later, a month later, a year later, all of a sudden it starts to get really raw and intense and difficult. And I would say that's the time where you might find a teacher to talk to so that they can encourage you and say, yes, you can look at that. You are safe. It's okay to feel that. And that's an aspect of the path.
So it sounds like you're going to have some questions among the meditation process, and then you'll find your answer about it in some way. So it sounds like the Buddha knows the truth, and he figured it out by himself. Does Buddha know everything?
Well, when you say Buddha, can I ask what you mean by Buddha?
Shakyamuni
Buddha, I mean this sincerely, is dead and died 2,500 years ago. And to me, Buddhism is a little different in that for me, and others may do this differently, I don't hold him up as a divine, omniscient being. He was the embodiment of every human being. So Shakyamuni Buddha is here. And Shakyamuni Buddha is here, and Shakyamuni Buddha is here. The thing that he awoke to was universal. And so it's not something outside of yourself that you need to acquire. And my understanding of his path as it's told, and it's a story we don't really know for sure, is he did have teachers. He tried different forms of meditation and different forms of asceticism. And if you look at some of the more magnificent stories, it talks about the teachers in his past lives. But simply put, he was a human being like you and like me. And you could say this is our Bodhi tree. And he sat down on a cushion of kusa grass, something comfortable. He made himself relatively comfortable, just like we can do. And he sat down under the tree and said, I'm going to sit here until I see the truth for myself. And so what I really appreciate about the path of Buddhism is that we're not looking for an exterior savior. But we're endeavoring to wake up to see that what we need to see is right here, and it's not separate from everything else. But we use an image like Shakyamuni Buddha to remind us of that, because it's hard to see that when we have so much negativity about ourselves at times. We have to have a reminder that says, I can do this, I can take that posture, and I can return.
There is a link to
I hope so. I don't know. I really do hope so. Maybe someone can come fix this mess. I really love that something else my teacher emphasizes. He says, don't believe, don't disbelieve, and don't look away. And there are things in this world being talked about that trigger belief, and they trigger disbelief, and they trigger ignorance or shutting down. And so you could bring the most outlandish thing to me. And I think what is great about the path is it says you can listen and you can enjoy and you can participate and you can play along, and you don't have to have any position on it. Are there ghosts? Are there aliens? Are there wood gnomes? I don't know, but I'm pretty curious. Yes.
So I'm pretty new to meditation, and in the process, I find 95% of the time my mind was not focused on breathing.
Yes.
It's like I can only focus on breathing when I'm very intentionally make myself focus on breathing for a very short period of time.
Yes.
And then if I got slightly relaxed, then I start to daydreaming or even play YouTube in my head.
Okay.
You know, all sorts of things.
Like, yeah.
I'm surprised all the random stuff that came up during the meditation. So is this normal or how, but like if I'm forcing myself to focus on breathing all the time, it doesn't feel very meditative. I don't know.
Yeah.
So how do I resolve this?
Thank you. Very good question. And again, every teacher is going to address this differently. My suggestion would be not to resolve it. What you just described to me is awareness. Awareness is watching. You cannot tell me that I'm watching my breath 5% of the time, and then I start wandering, and then YouTube and puppy dogs. You could not tell me that if you weren't aware of it. So you're watching the mind. And so if you want to use the breath as a point to return to, that's completely appropriate. I would say don't maintain it. Because when we start to maintain it and say, well, I have to sit for 20 minutes with my breath, never leaving it, it becomes very aggressive. It becomes more about living up to meditation. But if you say, I'm going to sit in meditation, going to observe my breath, and I'm also going to notice when the mind wanders away, and I'm going to notice my breath is still there, that would be very workable. To me, the expression of Zazen, or what I understand to be the traditional practice of Zen, would not need you to maintain anything and would not necessarily put up one reference point as better than another one. So it can be pretty chaotic, because the mind, it's like you were saying, where are all these thoughts coming from? And I think that is awareness. And so to continue to just return to look at how the judgment arises spontaneously. So the content's not a problem, but you notice how there may be some judgment of, I shouldn't be having that thought, or I need to stay with this thought. Continue to be aware of that. Look at the movement, look at the judgment, look at the returning, look at the departing. Everything is welcome.
But should I aspire to be more focused on breathing and less focused on the other stuff?
It's again going to depend on the teacher. And I would say, subjectively, no. I'm just speaking out of my practice. My practice is right here. And there is absolutely nothing special happening in my mind when I take this posture. I notice what arises. Sometimes I don't notice what arises. But I don't find any necessarily a point to return to. It's just you've been on a train, you rode a train before, yeah, so you have no say so how fast the train goes. The tracks are set and all sorts of scenery is going by, and all you can do there is watch. Not dissimilar from meditation, you take your seat as a passenger and the mind is like the scenery. Sometimes you're going through a beautiful countryside. Sometimes you're going through dilapidated buildings of the mind. And as a passenger, no matter how much you like or dislike it, it changes. And so there's no maintenance on the train. You just have to watch the scenery go by. So I would say meditation is similar to that. It just takes time, and you need to be reminded, or I had to be reminded, because I was so insistent that something special should be happening instead of just seeing that how special it is to just be with the mind as it shows up, the emotions. Thank you. Yes.
I'd like to speak to something I think about quite often is the ones that have discovered or realized that somehow in their own practice that we're all one mind and one of the same kind, and have come to this realization on their own, and try to share this, and people look to them as something separate, like you were saying earlier, right, as like an idol or something, and they want to learn this understanding. They want to have this realization for themselves. But I come to the thought a lot in my own head that, you know, that the moment that I realize that's a sort of truth that I can understand of the oneness of things, is the moment that I choose to observe that as a sort of reality and am able to work with some level of attainment in that regard. I don't know, there's all kinds of people throughout history that have done this, and you know, we all look to those people to try to understand, but it's the fact that we are them, you know. And I'm just curious as to what you think about that.
It sounds complicated. And I think what you're saying logically, very clear, very intelligent. I completely can follow you. Or maybe not, I don't know. But what you are thinking will not translate into anything but more thinking. And I would only encourage you to not get rid of the thinking, but notice if you're rejecting something because you feel like you have a more refined idea or thought, or that you're accepting something because it resonates with your ideas or thoughts. All of that's wonderful. The only thing I would offer to you, and it's not out of any attainment at all, is that a lot of time spent meditating seems necessary. A lot of time beginning to exhaust or wear out the striving of the self-centeredness. I'm not going to set up an amount of time for that, but there was a teacher named Kosho Uchiyama Roshi, and he told his students, sit for 10 years, and after 10 years, sit for another 10 years. And then when you're done with that, sit for 10 more years. He didn't go beyond that. I don't know what, I've not sat for 30 years yet. I'm only halfway. But I really think it's very important that you continue to explore intellectually and you study and you read and you look at how some things don't resonate and some things do, but that you take as much time as you can to do this practice, which endeavors to introduce it for yourself. And all I can say is that I have felt very confident at different points in my practice to only have it come crashing down because the confidence was based on my thoughts. The confidence was based on the thinking that I had attained something. Anything you attain, it's going to go away. Anything you get is coming apart. And so we just come back to that sitting in Zazen for Zazen's sake, sitting in this moment's sake, not for the next moment. And I think that it's helpful to find a good spiritual friend to help and to find a spiritual community to help, because this practice is hard to do on your own. So you have centers like Jikoji where you can come. It's kind of like a little bit of accountability. It helps. It helps when there's a room full of practitioners to say, yeah, I'm going to keep sitting here too. So make use of the structures that are there to support you in seeing for yourself.
Delusions, we're going to be saying this in a few minutes, delusions are inexhaustible. How do I vow to end them?
Yes.
Coming back sort of to,
yeah.
This is
the way my teacher says this is see that they're unreal. So if you want to get rid of your anger, see that it's unreal. And there, if it shows up, has no power. So delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to, how do you guys recite that?
I vow to end them.
I vow to end them. So our confusion, our fabrications, our belief in the nature of what this world is never ending. We're constantly producing thoughts about what we think our lives are and the lives of others are, inexhaustible. And as a bodhisattva or aspiring bodhisattva or someone who aspires to live for the benefit of others, I vow to end them. Well, they're inexhaustible. So the only way to end them is to see that they're endlessly unreal. And the only way we can do that is by looking very, very directly at how we feel that they are substantial and they are real. I think this is similar with the identity. We have these personality traits. We come back to the beginning. We have anger. We have passion. We have jealousy. And we want to get rid of them. I don't want to be an angry person. The anger is a problem because we believe it. And then we act out of it, or we believe it and we suppress it. So we're angry here. But we're endeavoring to see that it's insubstantial, not again, intellectually. It's not enough to tell yourself, well, my anger is unreal. So we need a practice where we actually begin to completely collapse into that unreality. Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche talked about it, like wearing out a shoe. You just have to keep stepping on the sole until all of a sudden you've worn through the entire shoe. That's what we're doing in meditation. It's like we're running a marathon for our lives until the shoes wear out. or Kōben Shinō Roshi. And one of the most moving things I read about Kōben Shinō Roshi is saying to one of his students who had cancer, he said, just practice until your death day. He didn't say, like, do something miraculous in this moment. He just said, give yourself to this practice until the end. Good to see you.
Yeah, I had I think you kind of answered my question when you were talking to this gentleman, but you know, you're talking about this rawness, and I've been listening to like Joseph Goldstein talking about the noble truths and a sort of a Theravadan framework, and just occurred to me that what the Buddha is really saying is you can be free from this wanting things to be a different way. But what I really want is to not feel that rawness and have a sense of peace. And it's like, oh, well, I don't actually want what Buddha's offering. I want something else. And I mean, it's like, you know, when I sit, I don't even know that until like maybe at the end of, you know, I sometimes like I bicycle to work, and a while ago, it was like, I was like 40 minutes anxious. And then all of a sudden, like right before I get to the office, like something relaxes. And I think for me in that meditation, it's like I can be caught in this wanting to be peaceful and wanting this raw feeling to like go away. That might take two meditations to like at the end, like ding, oh, you're off. You don't get it. I don't know. How do you think about, or how would you talk about that?
I come back to that it's okay to have comfort in your life, that if there are ways for you to live a life that's, you know, more comfortable, diet, exercise, having a therapist, these are really wonderful, powerful tools that allow us to live a life that is manageable. And all I would say is also continue to meditate. Like, they don't have to be mutually exclusive. So I would say both of those are okay. And the way I would say that is, I don't know that we can live without desire. I think that we can see desire so clearly, though, that it's not what leads our lives. And so I come back to that teaching of Linji of being ordinary, that your desire is not the obstacle. It's the belief that it will get you something. So the desire can continue to arise, but the delusion is thinking that through that desire, we'll actually be able to maintain something forever. We'll maintain the sense of equanimity forever. I do things that feel good. I love walking out here. It gives me a sense of ease. It's just beautiful land. It feels relaxing. And so I'm not, as a Buddhist monk, saying, well, don't do that because that relaxation's delusion. It's like, no, go for a walk and then get your ass to the zendo and sit there for a while until your knees hurt, and then go for another walk. So it doesn't have to be, Buddhism shouldn't be at war, but we should continue if we feel so inspired. I think I heard I would like to, before we close, just really, again, I cannot tell you how grateful I am to be here and the sincerity that is in this space and from those that facilitate its happening. So just tremendous gratitude to all of you and to Jikoji and the teachers that have made this happen. So I think we'll end with a dedication or closing verse.
May our intentions be good.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jikoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jikoji, please visit us on the web at jikoji.org.